Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. Among others, Andrew Jackson said that. But are we really being vigilant? Are we losing our liberties? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel, the current head of the American Civil Liberties Union, will be our guest. Call 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK to talk with Anthony Romero, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn@alaskapublic.org. That's a mouthful. Romero took his job just days before 9/11. More of a story coming on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, celebrating 7 years of educating Alaskans on clean, local, sustainable, renewable energy. Find out more online at realaska.org. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Anthony Romero seems to be a man in motion. He's just come back from Europe, just stepped into his office, just picked up the phone, and in another day or so, he's going to be in Alaska with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. And Jeffrey Mittman of Alaska American Civil Liberties Union joins us. Jeff, welcome to APRN.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I think we're actually hooked in with Anthony right now.
You are. And you missed one thing. I was in Washington, D.C. this morning. I stepped into my office. It was right off the shuttle from Washington. So,
well, how are you doing today?
Doing well. We've got a lot to do, as you can tell.
Well, yeah. I can't even picture what it must have been like in September of 1999 for you to suddenly come into this job of protecting people's civil liberties when before very long they would be very much under siege. Was it just gulp? Was it got to hit the ground running? I mean, what happened?
It was a bunch of things. It was a week before when I took over the job of the national director of the ACLU. And I hadn't even unpacked my boxes or even printed up my business cards. And I found myself in the middle of the biggest civil liberties crisis since the Second World War. And it was a big gulp. It was certainly get the legs moving as quick as you can because you knew what was in front of you. And, you know, in many respects, it brought us right back to the beginnings of the ACLU. The ACLU was founded in a very similar moment after World War I when there were a series of 33 bombs that went off the country and set off this enormous panic within the country. One bomb even went off on the doorstep of the Attorney General at the time, Mitchell Palmer.
Well, yes. Of all the people to be bombed, he would have to be a really inviting target.
Well, I don't know if anyone deserves to be bombed at their home.
No, I don't either.
I know you don't. I know you agree with me. I'm more of a pacifist. But it was a time when enormous immigration flows, especially from Europe. It was a time when the labor unions were beginning to get organized and a bit violent at times. And then you had these bombs that threatened to shake the entire American value system. And Mitchell unleashed the full fury of the Justice Department to deport the enemy within. At that time, there were Russians, there were Poles, there were Germans, many of them Jews, many of them summarily detained, thousands of them, hundreds of them deported with no due process. And then here I am almost 90 years later, reliving some of the same set of fears and fear-mongering and turning on immigrants in America, and it was right back to our roots.
And, there, you know, as you point out, there was disparate impact then. There's disparate impact now. But I have to say, you know, being somebody a bit older than you, I remember the next Red Scare that came after the Rosenbergs and all that.
Yeah, in the 50s.
Yeah. And that one was, you know, I was a little kid in that, and I was convinced that there were communists who were, you know, lurking in our little village in northern Pennsylvania. I would keep an eye out for them, as a matter of fact.
That was a time, actually, when the ACLU wasn't as strong. That was a time when, you know, fear of the communists made even some of our leadership expel communists who were on the board of the ACLU. There was much more complicity and relationships with Hoover and the FBI. It was one of our darkest chapters. That was not a time when we stood up as straight as we should have. So from that, you learn the lessons, the good and the bad, and you realize that with the events of 9/11, this would be a time when the ACLU's mettle would be tested, and that we would stand up for some of the key values, no matter how unpopular, no matter how difficult, no matter how much the fear, that this was a time to really make sure we stuck true to our values about who we are as Americans.
Well, any time that there is a war, Americans tend to be willing to relinquish their freedoms, at least for a while. But it seems after 9/11 that we had a war that never ended. First off, we had a war before that, which was the war on drugs. And then in addition to that, we had this war on terror. And it seemed that people were willing to give up, well, so long as they weren't Americans, they didn't have habeas corpus, for instance, just the beginning. And then, you know, all sorts of search issues.
Right, that affected Americans as well.
No-fly orders. I mean, there's no way. Do you think, I mean, the ACLU jumped in pretty quickly after 9/11. You did.
Right.
In your office.
Right.
To try and smoke out stuff that was being kept secret. And that's to your credit. But do you think you're gaining or losing ground right now?
Well, you know, I think this is, you have to look at it from a long-term perspective. I mean, even from the Red Scare of the 50s, it wasn't until the Church Committee hearings and some of the oversight mechanisms put in place in the 70s that we were able to rectify some of the damage done in the 50s. The reparations for Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II, for instance, took close to 60 years.
Yes, we had Aleuts in Alaska, and the same, they were interned too, and they were sort of piggybacked onto that bill. So, yes, we remember that well in Alaska.
And I think what's important is that what we were able to do in that time, in real time, was to kick up a very lively debate about our safety and our freedom. So they shouldn't be at loggerheads, that you can't have an either-or proposition. That was a Faustian bargain, that you had to keep America both safe and free. That if you had safety without freedom, you would have a dictatorship or a totalitarian regime. If you had freedom without safety, you would have anarchy. And that what defines America is the important need to have both, to balance both. And that's what we did from the beginning. I mean, from the very onset of the enactment of the Patriot Act, almost 90 days after the events of 9/11, it was really to the ramparts, where government began to seize greater law enforcement powers, greater surveillance powers, weakening the system of checks and balances. And many of the things that we all uphold as Americans, the idea that you're innocent until proven guilty, that you had the right to due process, that you had the right to rebut the evidence against you in a court of law, much of that was up for grabs. And I'm proud of the fact that even though we've lost a couple of the battles, that I think we were able to ignite a very lively debate, which is going to be ongoing for decades to come.
Yeah, I think you almost have to be right, and there's an educational element to it. Jeffrey Mittman of the Alaska ACLU, maybe you could jump in at this point and tell us what awaits Anthony when he gets here to town.
Oh, well, this is the first time Anthony has visited Alaska, and we're really excited to have him here. And Thursday night at UAA in the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, Anthony's going to be talking about one of the issues that affects us nationally and then here in Alaska as well, which is with the promise of equal opportunity, the question is, are we there yet? And we see across the country that there's disparate treatment of minority communities, underprivileged communities. We know that very well here in Alaska. And I think having Anthony here to talk about the work of the ACLU and how we address those issues is going to be very exciting. And I know we have a big crowd ready for him.
Yeah. So, you know, as you probably know, you're looking into the numbers, and I'm sure Jeffrey, Anthony, is feeding you some information, some background on Alaska. We got some serious problems. We got some domestic problems, and we have some all sorts of disparate impacts, in particular on Alaska Natives. I mean, you see it in our justice system. You see it in the teen suicide rate, for Pete's sake. And I don't think there's easy solutions here.
Well, it'd be interesting for me to see what Alaska's like again. I haven't been at the Alaska affiliate since I became director of the ACLU, but I was there once. And about 17 years ago, where I was the guest of the Native American Rights Fund.
Ah.
This is another great group that does work on behalf of Native American issues all across the country. They have a small office, at least they did at the time, in Alaska. And I remember from my time then, and I remember now from the briefing materials that Jeffrey's given me, it's just, you know, the disparate impact that we see, especially among the Native Alaskan populations, the low-income communities. Those are stark, and lamentably, they're similar to what our the challenges we confront among minority communities all across the country. The whole question around how they're targeted by police, their overpresence in the state and the federal prison system, the lack of educational opportunity for low-income and for Alaskan Natives is something that we have to redouble our efforts on, because they are an important part of the Alaskan population, important American citizens. They have a unique history, obviously, as Native Americans who recognize tribes as a nation to a nation, with responsibilities from the federal government to their nations. And obviously, this requires much more attention. Alaska is lamentably one of those states that tends not to get the attention it deserves, partly because it's so far away, it's out of sight, out of mind. Most people only think about the beautiful landscapes. They don't think about the beautiful people who sometimes suffer there. And I think it would be important to raise up some of the kind of the major social issues that are confronting us in Alaska.
Thank you. We're speaking with Anthony Romero. He's executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, and he's soon to be in Alaska, as Jeffrey Mittman of the Alaska ACLU has been telling us. And our telephone number, I think it would be a good point to bring that in, is 478-8255, 478-TALK, to talk with Anthony or Jeffrey. A local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. And Lord have mercy, there's so many things to talk about. We have so many. ACLU has been very busy in Alaska. And
yep.
Anthony, tell me, are you an attorney? Are you practicing attorney?
I am. I'm an attorney. I haven't practiced in a number of years, but luckily I leave the lawyering to the lawyers who still have a very good license that they keep up with. Mine is just shoved away on a wall somewhere. But I did study law. I was a graduate of Stanford and licensed in New York. But at this time, it would be malpractice if I took on a case other than cheer the lawyers on from behind the well of the courtroom.
And Jeffrey, your background?
I'm in the exact same position as Anthony. I used to practice law in California, but I'm not a member of the Alaska Bar. But it certainly helps to be aware of the issues our phenomenally talented lawyers raise.
Yeah. Well, I am. I had no idea you had so many cases here in Alaska.
Yep.
This has been very busy, and I guess a credit to you and a credit to your board. And your fundraising abilities, or the pro bono abilities of the attorneys that are volunteering for you. Maybe you could explain to me, Jeffrey, how this basically works. I mean, I know you have a board. I probably know half your board members or more. A lot of them are attorneys, but not necessarily. And what does it take to make an ACLU case?
Right. And I think one of the reasons we're so active here is I don't want to embarrass Anthony, it's because of the way he structured the organization. We are unique in that the ACLU of Alaska is an independent organization, but we have all the resources of the National ACLU available to us. So, for example, one of our cases where we're challenging the discriminatory treatment of same-sex couples, we're bringing with the ACLU's National LGBT Rights Project. And that's currently before the court. We're on a motion for summary judgment. Similarly, a few years ago, up before the Alaska Supreme Court.
Now, wait a minute. I got to stop because I got to know more about the case.
Okay. So what happens is if you are a married couple and one of the couple is over the age of 65 or one of them is a disabled veteran, you get up to a $150,000 exemption on the taxation of your property. Unfortunately, if you're a same-sex couple, married in all but name, been together for many years, relying on each other, what the state has said is that you are not entitled to that exemption. They treat you as if you're legal strangers, essentially roommates. We believe that's unconstitutional. It's denial of equal protection. So we are challenging the application of that rule and hope the court will agree with us and ensure that lesbian and gay families will be treated equally and that the importance and validity of their relationships will be recognized.
I think I have to pursue that a little bit more, because it's my understanding that this is not the first time this has come up with regards to state law. And I don't think you've had to really get too many verdicts on this. I thought the state usually settled these things because it's kind of pretty clear cut.
In the case of Alaska Civil Liberties Union v. Alaska, which was decided by the Alaska Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said on a purely rational basis, it was simple discrimination because the Constitution denied same-sex couples the right to marry, they could never take advantage of the benefits that were offered to opposite-sex married couples. And on that basis, the state Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. I think what's interesting is we see this playing out on the national stage, and Anthony could probably fill you in on an important federal case that the national ACLU is bringing along the same lines.
Yeah, Anthony, a federal case?
Yeah, and I think what's important here is that it's the same premise that Jeffrey outlined, is that until and unless we recognize same-sex couples with the same legal protections and the same vigor that we do for straight couples, we're treating them like strangers under the law. The idea that you have couples that have been in committed, monogamous, long-term relationships for decades, and yet they have none of the rights and protections that their heterosexual counterparts do is just unfair, un-American, and unconstitutional. We have this great client in New York. Her name is Edie Windsor, 82-year-old woman. She was one of the first women to break through the glass ceiling at IBM. She had been with her partner, Thea Speier, for 47 years and lived a committed, happy, lovely life. When Thea was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, she turned to Edie and said, "What do you say we get married?" They've been engaged forever, and they decided they're going to fly up to Canada and get married. They got married. New York has a law that says they recognize marriages at that time. This is before we now allow same-sex marriages here in New York as of 2 weeks ago. But at that time, New York didn't recognize marriages performed in New York. But they did acknowledge and recognize marriages performed outside the state. So Edie and Thea go up to Canada. They're lawfully married spouses. They come back to New York. Thea dies. Now, everyone always says, well, what's the big deal about marriage? If you can be same, you know, if you can be civil unions, so you can be domestic partners, why do you need to be legally married? Well, in the case of Edie Windsor, it's very clear. She was married. But because New York cannot recognize her marriage for federal purposes because of the Defense of Marriage Act, she had to pay $375,000 in estate taxes that had she been married to a man and inherited her husband's estate, she wouldn't have had to pay. Now, when you're talking about an 82-year-old woman, a widow, in a long-term relationship that goes over four decades, and they say, what's the difference between civil unions or domestic partnerships and married? It means that lovely little old lady had to pay almost $400,000 because you don't recognize her marriage to Thea, because she's a stranger to Thea for purposes of the law. And that case that we filed in New York was the one that finally pushed the Obama administration to say that they could not defend the Defense of Marriage Act, that it was unconstitutional, that whenever you treat gay people differently from straight people, that requires a level of heightened scrutiny. It's a legal term. That means you really have to look very closely at why are you doing that? Is there a discriminatory purpose? And in this case, we think that there clearly is. And it might be the presidential lawsuit that undoes the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level.
Wow. So what happens with this now? Who's defending it?
Well, it's great. It's a great question. Since the Obama administration and the Justice Department,
right,
this is a law we can't defend. It was the House leader, Mr. Boehner, who then retained a top lawyer out of Atlanta to defend the DOMA statute in front of the appellate court. So it's by no means is it over. It's something that obviously is going to be a lot of wrangling. There's a very mixed message that's being sent. But when you have the Justice Department, the Obama administration, not defending a statute passed by Congress, and then only one house of the Congress, the House of Representatives, controlled by the Republicans, decide they're going to take up the gauntlet. So it's really a little bit of uncharted territory. But we're rather clear that given the facts and circumstances, when you make it real for people, when you tell the story, that this isn't about, you know, a special right. So this isn't about, you know, enabling these communities that we're afraid of. This is about recognizing our neighbors, our coworkers, our colleagues. This is about a person like Edie Windsor, who lived her life with dignity, paid her taxes she's 82 years old, has done the time, has been a contributor to society, has been one of the trailblazer women who's broken through the glass ceilings of corporate America. And she deserves to be treated fairly. And that's why we think ultimately cases like this are important, because the more you can make them real, the more you can tell the stories, the more you can show people, the real human faces of the indignity, of the discrimination, the prejudice, the more people are willing to open up and say, wait a minute, that's not right. I have it. I'm an optimist. You know, that's the only way I can get up in the morning and keep running at the speed I am.
Well, yeah, I would think so, because I would be a little scared of the Supreme Court on this one.
No, you know what? I think at the end of the day, when people look at the set of facts and circumstances, when you have a compelling client, a compelling set of facts, that speaks to people's minds and hearts. That I want to believe that even some of the worst members of the Supreme Court who don't always agree with us, at the end of the day, they are fair-minded people who want to believe in equality and justice. And I even think that some of the right-wingers in the Supreme Court, when confronted with a set of facts of an E.D. Winter, who would be their contemporary, perhaps even their elder in some cases, like Chief Justice Roberts, and they would see in her the possibility that that could be their great aunt or that could be their grandmother's sister, the same thing, that they would feel a set of empathy. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to invoke. I mean, the work on civil liberties.
Well, they could take the court could take the course of kicking it back to the states, right? Maybe this is really the state's business, anyways. Who can get married and who can't?
Ridiculous. But look at the states on miscegenation, right? If we had to go to every state by state to fight the ban on interracial marriages, we would still be fighting them today.
I mean,
the only way we were able to allow for interracial couples to marry was one of our cases, Loving versus Virginia, Mildred Loving, who brought the case with ACLU as her lawyers. Now, if we had not won at the federal level, the Supreme Court level, how long would it have taken us to convince Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, state by state? When you're dealing with a fundamental right, like your basic right as a human being, we don't let the states decide that. And ultimately, it's a question of the Constitution. It's a question for the Supreme Court.
I see. Yeah, I can see South Carolina would still be if it could. We're talking to Anthony Romero of the American Civil Liberties Union. Our telephone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Jeffrey Mintman, we're just hearing Anthony tell us about, some people involved in a case who is very easy to sympathize with. In fact, he's even hoping the justices of the Supreme Court are going to sympathize with this couple, one of whom survives now. I'm thinking that sometimes you probably really need to be real careful who the client is. You want the best possible or the best possible stack of clients. Like in this one that you have on property taxes pending right now that you just started, you have a whole bunch of them.
You know, you raise an interesting question, and I'm a little younger than you, but I remember when I was a child that the ACLU got a lot of bad press for defending the right of Nazis to march in Skokie. And I was raised Jewish, and to me that was very important, not because I believed in the Nazi message, but because it struck me that here's an organization that believed in a principle, free speech, and was willing to do the right thing no matter what. And the ACLU continues that to this day. We've defended or argued for the right, for example, of Fred Phelps, a very hateful, anti-gay, essentially bigot. However, under our Constitution, he has the right of free speech. The ACLU will stand up for the principles of the Constitution, wherever that takes us. We don't just stand up when it's popular. And oftentimes, we're the only organization who will defend someone's rights. Right now, we have a case, a gentleman who's incarcerated. He was found guilty but mentally ill, and the state's denying him the opportunity to even go before the parole board to find out if he's can have parole. Now, we're not defending what he did or saying he's a good person or a bad person. That's not the point. The point is that we have to be a system of laws. The laws have to be applied fairly. And the ACLU nationally and all of the states that we are present, that's the principle we follow. And that's what our members want us to follow.
Anthony Romero, freedom of speech has just been broached. And I think that may be one of our most difficult areas right now, because I think what might be called seditious speech might easily be under threat during these days. And I think also when we look at search and seizure, that we're seeing situations now where law enforcement, particularly the FBI, can feels free really to to do a little bit more than maybe the Constitution, you would think, says.
Well, I couldn't have said it better than the way that Jeffrey said it. In every respect, it's often the pariah groups or the most marginal or the least powerful whose rights are often infringed upon. And even when you look at some of the most egregious violations, whether it's violations of prisoners on death row or violations of due process at Guantanamo or efforts to shut down the free speech rights of groups you hate like the Nazis or Fred Phelps, those are instances where unless you engage it and unless you take on those set of issues, you run the risk of making exceptions for what should be ironclad rules. And if you allow the government, in the context of free speech, for instance, to say, we're going to ban this speech, but we're going to allow this speech, well, it's like shooting poison gas in the wind. You think you're shooting poison gas in one direction, and then the wind might begin to blow in the opposite direction and blows the poison gas right back in your face.
Oy.
And that's why it's been one of the core principles of this organization, that no matter how much you hate the speech you hear, the only answer to speech you hate is more speech. And that's why we defended all sorts of clients that Jeffrey outlined, from the Nazis to the KKK, Rush Limbaugh, when they went after his medical records, when they tried to prove that he was hooked on hydrocodone. We came to his defense. He had the same right to medical privacy that women have invoking late-term abortions. When a funny case of Senator Larry Craig, you know, the wide stance fellow who was tapping his foot at the public restroom, well, even if he was soliciting sex, that was free speech. In America, you have the right to solicit sex wherever you want. Most normal people do it at a bar or a party. You don't have a right to have sex in public bathrooms, but free speech is free speech. We jumped to his defense. And I think we went to the defense of Oliver North during the around Contragate hearings when they tried to pierce his right to Fifth Amendment immunity, the right not to self-incriminate. And it's really important to underscore the fact that even in the most difficult of circumstances, those are the cases you have to stand up for. Much of the work we've done after 9/11, for instance, we have defended some pretty unsavory fellows. A lot of our clients in Guantanamo are not people I would want to sit down and have dinner with. But it's often the case that it's often the most hated and the most unsavory of clients that find themselves in the crosshairs of law enforcement. And Mary Poppins does not get waterboarded. It's got to be someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And it's not about whether Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is innocent or guilty about being the mastermind behind 9/11 attacks. It's about who we are as Americans. It's about whether or not we as Americans believe that we should engage in torture as a way to gain information out of individuals.
Yeah.
And when we raise that question, it's about holding the mirror in front of us and not putting the frame around the client. It's about asking us to look in the mirror and say, who are we as Americans? What do we really believe in? And often those are the hardest cases for us, but those are the ones that really test our convictions. And I think in the end of the day, no matter what the furor, no matter what the difficulty, no matter how many members might quit, the organization went almost bankrupt during the years that Jeffrey described during the Skokie controversy. We had half of our membership resign in protest. We would have gone under had it not been for a small band of stalwarts who stepped up. And I still think that was one of our finest moments, absolutely the right call. And it's been the one that's been a raison d'etre on all of our work from Guantanamo to the hate speech cases that we now confront each day.
How are you doing money-wise? How's the ACLU doing? I would think that we're in a time when it could be pretty unpopular. Like, for instance, standing against
it's awful. It's awful. I mean, let me tell you. It's the perfect storm. In a lot of ways, it's the idea that among many that President Obama has come in and fixed everything, which he has not. In fact, in many areas, he's done a great job, like on the gay rights issue, on some of the issues around the crack and powder cocaine disparity, certainly around civil rights enforcement, voting rights issues. But in some of the core issues having to do with the war on terror, his policies are very much like those of George Bush. In fact, there's been very little difference among them in practice, in real terms. So you have this, the entry of a president who looks and sounds and sometimes is often much more progressive than the former president. And then you've got this economic crisis which looms around the horizon everywhere you turn. And so it's this buffeting between both the political climate and the economic climate. And the fact is that one thing people don't realize is that we don't take any federal money. we have a small little endowment that gives us about $3.5 million a year when we have about $170 million in expenses. We have 900 staff nationwide. We have an office in every state. The bulk of our staff, 600 plus, are in the states. And so we scramble for it. This is shoe leather fundraising. It's, you know, it's not glamorous. We don't do celebrity events. Hollywood is not, you know, our back pocket, but we do it because we believe in it. And the fact is that most of our donors...
Anthony, you're spamming me every couple of days, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
asking me for money. There is Anthony, got his hand out again.
And the fact is that most of our contributors, almost a quarter of our budget, comes from people who write us a check from $20 to $59, about $20 to $60. The average gift is $60.
All right, thank you.
And they're ordinary people from everywhere all across the country. If it weren't for those folks, we would have a much harder time of it.
Our guest is Anthony Romero of the American Civil Liberties Union. He's on his way to Alaska. We have Jeffrey Mittman of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska with us as well as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Anthony Romero has been executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union since September of 1999, back in the last century.
2001.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. It was 2001, wasn't it? And so there you are, you know, just the very beginning of the century. And you take this job, and it's been an odd time to be an American ever since.
So, it's been a great time.
Yeah,
it's a great time because you also have the time to make these issues come alive, to have a public debate. When I was first thinking about this job, I thought that one of the challenges I would have to do is how do you make the ACLU relevant for today? I was 35 years old when I started, and a lot of my friends said it's a great organization, but don't you think its heyday has passed? I said, well, I don't think so. I think its heyday is always in front of it. And in a lot of respects, 9/11 made our work and our efforts and our values even more salient and more relevant for this community and for this generation. So I think it's a real honor and a privilege to be standing up for what you believe in at this time.
Anthony will be in Anchorage to speak at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, and it's a free, open to the public event. He'll speak on disparate opportunity in America, the ongoing struggle for equal rights at 7 o'clock in Anchorage. And Jeffrey Mittman is with us of the ACLU of Alaska. And Jeffrey, I wanted to go right into this. We were just talking about Skokie. We were talking about some unpopular people that ACLU has stood behind, people that some of our listeners probably would not agree with, such as, say, Rush Limbaugh. One outfit that you stood behind was the Public Inebriates in Anchorage.
You know, it's interesting. The Anchorage Assembly and the mayor had passed an ordinance that said on 12 hours' notice, the police could go in and throw out the property of homeless persons.
Well, now they're trespassing, Jeff.
Right. Well, and that was the other thing is we saw a lot of comments where said everybody knows they're breaking the law. I said, wait a second. The way I was raised, we don't know anything until we've had a trial. So there's this presumption of guilt and a presumption that their property didn't matter because they're not like us. I was really pleased. We got a lot of responses from people who said, you know what? I may not like the ACLU. I may not agree with everything you do, but I understand what you're doing and I'm glad you're doing it. Because we were very clear. The principle is you can't just take somebody's property, their driver's license, their sleeping bag, their tent, and throw it away. Everybody has the right to due process. Everybody has the right to notice. Everybody has the right to the opportunity to be heard. And again, what's fascinating is these are not issues that are unique to Anchorage, not issues that are unique to Alaska. Anthony and the lawyers at the national level have had to deal with these issues all across the country.
Would you consider...
What's funny about... When you add the... Excuse me for interrupting, but there's...
That's okay.
You add this coda of what's playing out on the mortgage foreclosure issue.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the same issue. We saw this great lawsuit in Florida where because of the scale of foreclosures of many working class and middle class people, they've had to set up a special foreclosure court where they've allocated about $9 million for a special foreclosure court. And they have systematically cut every corner around notice, around due process, around figuring out who's got property rights and who doesn't. And it is of a scale that is exactly the same set of issues we confront in the homeless litigation in Alaska and in Southern California, for instance, where they try to endeavor to take people's property rights without giving them the full notice, the full due process rights that you would in a normal civil court. And I think when you kind of make that connection for folks, that it's as much about some of the folks who are in real dire straits in Florida because of the economy, because of the banks fleecing them with these subprime lending products. And you think about the fact that taking away someone's home in Florida who've been trying to make ends meet and thought they had done had the American dream with their homes, and you kind of make them understand that some of the same process issues are the things that the homeless folks confront in Anchorage and in Los Angeles, maybe you get a different type of debate that's going on about those issues.
It would seem that due process is one of the most vulnerable ones when I think about it. It's very easy to chip away at, and, you know, as Anthony was explaining here.
It is, and I was very heartened. You know, people presume that the ACLU is a progressive organization or a liberal organization or a democratic organization. I was very pleased when we brought the homeless litigation that a lot of conservative thinkers here in Anchorage, here in Alaska, got right away at what they were doing and were there with us and said, you know what? Property rights are property rights. The government cannot take them away without giving you notice, without giving you a chance to be heard, without giving you a chance to make your case. And there were a lot of principled people who joined up and stood and said, the ACLU is right. And I think that's, again, a strength of our organization is it's not about partisanship. It's not about ideology. It's about the amazing documents that founded our country.
Would you consider taking the graffiti case on? Poor old Mino that has been decorating our public walls here and finally got busted?
You know, it's an interesting issue. When is something art? When is something free expression? When is something breaking law? Anthony, have we had any graffiti or public art cases at the national level?
We've had. I mean, there are places where some of the work, especially of protesters, when they do some of the chalk graffiti, that's not permanent, it's not damage on either public buildings or private property. Those are often the easier ones. Much harder to win on a context where you're dealing with government buildings or private buildings. And again, it's one of those places where you have to balance these competing interests. Certainly you want to encourage the freedom of expression, artistic expression. We have great artists like Basquiat and others who, you know, hang in the museums of the Museum of Modern Art and the National Gallery in London, who are renowned artists because of they started as street artists. At the same time, you also understand the need for protecting private and public property. And it's often the case about looking at how zealously they're prosecuted, where the context and circumstances, whether it's permanent damage or whether in cases where it's not permanent damage, whether it's just a way to try to subvert folks from expressing their First Amendment rights.
Yeah, well, you know, it's fascinating. I'm getting a picture of the thinking process that ACLU might go through when it's thinking about taking a case. And who makes the call ultimately, Jeffrey? Is it you? Is it your board?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a great question. For example, one of the things we would be particularly sensitive to is viewpoint discrimination. We are the safeguard against the government imposing their view, whether or not it's in favor of one side or another. So, for example, if the state of Alaska were allowing graffiti that was in favor of equal marriage rights for same-sex couples and disallowing against, that'd be something we'd be concerned about. But, yeah, your question is we have a board of directors who are the organization. They're the voice and conscience of the organization, and we review litigation for a few things. One, does the ACLU have particular expertise and resources that we can bring that nobody else has? Two, Is this a client who, but for us, their rights might not be protected? And three, is this an important principle that protects not only the rights of these individuals, but protects all the rights? And if those three are answered, usually the board will say, let's jump in, let's commit resources to defending that
and
right.
I'm thinking in those resources has to be the attorney, too.
It's the attorney. We have wonderful cooperating attorneys. There's great attorneys here in Alaska and throughout the country who assist us. They volunteer their time and their expertise.
Right.
They understand the importance of the work we do.
But this is a lot of work, and often they're going to be uncompensated.
It's a lot of work.
Most of the time, probably.
Usually they volunteer their time and they contribute to the ACLU. But again, they understand, but for the ACLU, these rights would be chipped away. And once they're gone, they're very hard to get back.
So let's take, for instance, our subject of last week, which was the bong hits for Jesus thing, a case that you guys lost. Doug Mertz, he was working for nothing on that, huh?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There were actually two issues there. One at the United States Supreme Court, and Anthony can fill in a little more. The United States Supreme Court said that this was a quote-unquote pro-drug message. We think that was wrong for a lot of decision. But what's interesting, at the state level, on the state issue and the state free speech rights, actually that case was settled in favor of the plaintiff because there was an understanding that protections under the Alaska Constitution for privacy, for free speech rights, in some cases are even stronger than those at the federal level. So we'll call it a split decision.
Okay.
I think what's important to underscore there is that the Supreme Court, that's usually very good on free speech and First Amendment rights, there are two places where they fall short. It's often with minors and students, and often when they're concerned about drugs. And it was clear to me that some of the folks, I went to the Supreme Court argument, I go to every one of our cases whenever we're in front of the Supreme Court and sit behind the lawyers and wish them on and take them out to lunch with their family members afterwards and raise a glass to them. So I was there in the court when this was being discussed. And I have to say, I don't think many of the Supreme Court justices, or a bunch of them, didn't really fully understand what bonk hits for Jesus was. And in fact,
None of us do. Come on.
I think that's exactly the point. It was satire. It was funny. It was this kid who was given a day off from school, told that he should line that route if he wanted to, expressing his First Amendment rights, got a little bit of notoriety from it, but then it blew into this tempest in a teapot, and it was just this kind of set of circumstances where you had students who were not in school, but released during school time, raising a sign that had a lot of people perplexed, and so they could draw the worst of conclusions for it. And so those set of facts made a bad precedent. But I actually think it's one of those places where, you know, they carved it so narrowly that it doesn't have the same kind of broad implications for the First Amendment that would otherwise be the case.
Yeah,
it does. I think the court is always very good and very clear at protecting First Amendment free speech rights. And this one, they circumscribed it so much so that it really is particular to a set of circumstances with that particular student.
Although, you know, as you point out, if it's school and if it's kids and if it's drugs, you know, there's like three things there. And the result is kids in school can pretty much be subject to random drug testing now, random searches.
We had another Supreme Court case, this case of Savannah Redding. She's a high school junior. She was in school. She had another classmate of hers who had been her friend and then turned on her and then turned her into the school officials for packing contraband in her panties. She was alleged to have been carrying Tylenol in her underwear. She was subjected to a full strip search. Just on the allegation of one of her classmates. She found not to be carrying Tylenol. The girl dropped out of high school because it was just so humiliating she could barely stand it to look back at the teachers and the administrators who had looked in her underwear. And we lost that case in the Supreme Court, 5-4. And that was a case that was interesting to me because it was clearly around some of the gender lines that the men on the Supreme Court say, oh, what's the big deal, you know, a strip search. Even Justice Breyer, who's normally pretty good, was completely clueless when it came to these issues. Oh, you know, in gym class and the showers and everything. And it was Justice Ginsburg who read a very scathing part of her dissent from the bench, who tried to explain that for adolescent girls, the idea of their bodily integrity may have very different circumstances and implications than for young boys.
Well, oh boy, I'm sure you'll get the phones thundering on that one, Anthony. I want to go to Roger, joins the program from White Mountain now. Roger, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Jeffrey and Anthony.
Oh, good morning, Jeffrey and Anthony and Steve. I got a comment. Living in this country of the United States of America, everybody knows we live in a democracy. Democracy blankets the vast or majority of its citizens. And there are people in who fall through the cracks. Sometimes democracy works and sometimes it doesn't. It was that way yesterday. It will be that way today. And it will be that way tomorrow. It's not perfect, but it's the best system in this world. Live with it. Thank you. Have a nice day.
All right, Roger. Well, thank you very much.
I agree with them. It's the best democracy in the world. And part of the reason why we've gotten better is because we fought for those rights. And in fact, the reason why we have civil rights laws that have gotten us closer to the promise of equal opportunity is because groups like the ACLU and the NAACP and others have fought for those rights. And so he's absolutely right. There's no other country I'd rather live in. And there's no other country I'd rather fight to make a more perfect union than this one. And that's why we've been around for 90 years, and we've been around for 90 more, 90 more, so that we can get closer to that perfection.
And the fight continues. I mean, I was pleased when I first came up to Alaska, we were right in the middle of a landmark case with the Native American Rights Fund. And because of the work of the Native American Rights Fund and the ACLU, we got the first ever court-ordered protections for Yupik-speaking elders in the Bethel area so that they had the full right to vote, and democracy was perfected a little bit more because of the work of the ACLU and NARF. And, you know, it's a constant struggle. We can never give up, but I like to think we're making progress, and little by little, we're making it better and better.
I remember that case. Let's go to Jenny, joins the program from Sitka. Jenny, you're on Talk of Alaska with the ACLU.
Good morning. I was intrigued by the comment about Mary Poppins as not being waterboarded. And I think that in the history of our country, in times of turmoil, the rights of women are often overlooked. We saw that in World War One with attempts to take citizenship away from American women who were married to foreign nationals, some of the violence perpetrated against suffragists. And I think we see it in this war. We certainly see it in brutal assaults on service women and American contractors. Right. And in our airports. And for women in Alaska, flying is not an option. We have to fly to see our families, to get basic services. And, as a woman, every time I fly, it's an incredibly humiliating experience. Yeah. And so I think that that violence against women and subjugations of women's rights have been a really tragic part of this particular frenzy in America right now.
I couldn't agree with you more. And let me just clarify and apologize. I didn't mean by my comment that Mary Poppins
wasn't insulted, but I think that
But I wanted to just make clear. It could have been. I'm trying to think would be an equivalent. I'm drawing a blank. Howdy Doody doesn't get waterboarded. It wasn't to say that women don't have difficulty with their rights. And in fact, the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU was founded by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was our key litigator, staff lawyer, then became director, then became general counsel of the ACLU, who brought all these great women's rights cases. And I think you'll be hard to know about. We have this one lawsuit, our current Women's Rights Project, which takes on the very first question you raised about the level of rape and violence against women serving in the military. And we have a great group of plaintiffs. It's been an issue that's always been skirted and under the rug. These women who put their lives on the line for America and then get abused, sometimes on the battlefield, sometimes by contractors, sometimes by fellow soldiers, sometimes by superiors, really needs to get much closer attention. And it's a very vibrant piece of our docket. We often talk about the one founder of the ACLU being Roger Baldwin. In fact, he was joined by three of the major suffragists, Jane Addams, Crystal Eastman, and Margaret Sanger, who was also the founder of Planned Parenthood. And so we're totally with you there. I think it's even though we've come a long way in gender equality, just like we've come a long way in racial equality, we're not there yet, and it requires our vigilant attention.
Well, thank you for your work.
And you'll be pleased to know as well, we have an important case going on right now. The state came in and seized the records of 400 women down in Ketchikan out of a midwife clinic. We are challenging that, ensuring that women's private medical information, information they share about sexually transmitted diseases, about pregnancies, about other conditions, is kept private from the government. So it's a continuing battle at the national level. It's a continuing battle here in Alaska.
Thank you. Thanks for your call, Jenny. We're talking with Jeffrey and Anthony as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Anthony Romero and Jeffrey Mittman of the American Civil Liberties Union are with us on Talk of Alaska, phone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and Angela from Anchorage joins us. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Angela.
Thank you, and thank you to your guests for being here today. I'll try to keep it really short. I'm sure that they are both aware that environmental activists are being targeted in the lower 48 for legal acts of civil disobedience. They're being surveilled. Their houses are being raided. All their computers are being taken. I am very, very concerned about my fellow citizens in Bristol Bay and in other fishing communities to be able to fight for their right to continue to fish without being labeled a terrorist.
Yeah. What? So yeah, I guess your question, Angela, is
is a terrorist being in trouble?
Yeah, a terrorist is being a bit misused now.
It sure is.
What advice do they have to
the people of Bristol Bay?
Yeah.
I don't know the circumstances in Bristol Bay, but I do know that each year the Justice Department has to produce a report on the USA Patriot Act. That was the very controversial anti-terrorism law. That was passed through in record time after 9/11, and it gave the government very sweeping powers that no one really fully appreciated just how much that would fundamentally change the whole idea of unreasonable searches or seizures or due process rights.
Right.
And when you look at that report from Congress, that report from the Justice Department submitted to Congress, rather, it is remarkable just how much it has creeped into other areas. They talk about their targeting of animal rights groups and environmentalist groups. PETA has often been the subject of sub-surveillance, also Greenpeace. Also, you have groups like the Quakers, who have found themselves in the crosshairs of the FBI and some of the surveillance undertaken by the government. We know this through our Freedom of Information Act litigation. And then you find that the use of technology has evolved in such a way that now they're able to seize the records of individuals with very little oversight. And it's interesting to me that one of the cases we recently brought was on behalf of a group of businessmen and women whose laptops were seized at the airport. And these are businessmen and women who have often trade secrets or confidential memos, illegal memoranda. And when the government says, we're just going to hold on to your laptop to see what you've got on it, we'll give it back to you, that has enormous implications for someone who's conducting either a business that might go public or looking for a trademark or copyright. And so you find now that these law enforcement powers are sweeping into, you know, activists, whether environmentalists or animal protesters or even in the business community. And I think that's one of the issues that you raised earlier. The war on terror is not like any other war. This will never come to a public decisive end. There's no clear enemy. There's no Japanese emperor, no Third Reich. There's no Mussolini. This is a decentralized enemy from all sorts, from all corners of the earth. And it will never come to a public decisive end. So the liberties we give up in the so-called war on terror are likely to be with us for a very long time. They're going to define the way we think about our liberties and our rights. And that, perhaps, is the most pernicious part of the so-called war on terror, is that it will fundamentally reshape the way we think about life day to day, in a context that sees no end.
Well, yeah, but I think Angela's question is, what is to be done?
Well, I understand that, but I want to know how the people of Bristol Bay can protect themselves from these abuses.
And
what I would say is, if there are any, right, Angela?
There will be.
Angela, what I would tell you is contact the ACLU office, AKCLU, at akclu.org. That'll come right to my desk, let you and I talk about the particulars and see if this is something where the ACLU can be of assistance.
Thank you very
much. And also, if you go to aclu.org, there's a part of our website which will walk you through how to file a Freedom of Information Act request to get a file on any particular group or organization or individual. So you can begin to see whether or not the government's been compiling data on you. And then when you begin to see what they've got on you, then we can take the next steps about making sure that stops.
Angela, thanks for your call from Anchorage. Let's go to Leslie, joins the program from Wasilla. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Leslie?
Good morning. Morning. So we hear a lot from Republican politicians during Supreme Court nomination processes about judicial activism on the left. But I think from a lot of the decisions we've seen lately, that judicial activism is happening from the right. And I wonder if you could just comment on that.
Yes, well, that was also a point that James Foster made in our program last week. But, yeah, Anthony Romero, why don't you grab on that one?
Yeah, no, I think it's an important point. I mean, especially when you look at some of the more kind of egregious cases of judicial activism from the right. I mean, everything from the Bush v. Gore case, where it was clearly split along partisan lines, where it was clear that this wasn't a question about deferring to states. It was the greatest of ironies. Here you have the Supreme Court, with a majority often deferring to states' rights, stepping into the state of Florida and telling them exactly how to count their ballots and which ones to count and which ones not to count. It was completely had the world was on its head there. You find the same set of issues, especially around the Citizens United case, which is their campaign finance litigation, where the court went much broader and decided not the question about whether or not this movie made against Hillary Clinton could be banned under the campaign finance rules. I actually believe that that film should not have been banned under the campaign finance rules, that in fact it's political speech, and an effort to muzzle that type of political speech precisely when it matters most was anathema to the First Amendment. Now, the court went a thousand steps further than what they needed to. They could have just said, you shouldn't be able to broadcast that movie. They went further and said that corporations should have the right to donate directly into the campaigns of candidates for office. I mean, it wasn't just the first step. They went from step A to step Z. And there are any number of places where you can point to where the court really does contort itself in terms of its understanding of issues and ends up at an outcome based merely upon its ideological proclivities.
Well, now, if we had a second hour, we could go around to say, well, what do you do if you can't get it through the Supreme Court? What's the alternative? But we're not going to have time for that.
But, well, folks, I think the key thing is that you just have to make those battles. And even when you lose a case in the Supreme Court, it's about setting the stage for a future battle. You had to have Plessy versus Ferguson, which was an anti-civil rights case, to be able to have a Brown versus Board of Education. Yeah. You had to lose Bowers versus Hartwick in Georgia so you could have the Lawrence case out of Texas.
All right, we're out of time. More from Anthony Romero in Anchorage on Thursday evening at the Wendy Williamson. Jeffrey Mittman,
it's
thanks.
It's a free program, and people will have a chance to meet Anthony afterwards.
All right, thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, Heather Orono. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.